Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
All right, so welcome to our season finale, episode 10.
I can't believe it's finally here.
I'm Matt Hart Spade.
And I'm Jenners.
And this is Mixtape Memories.
Yay.
Thanks for sticking with us. So I feel like for some reason the last few episodes we've talked about a lot of male-fronted acts, from emo to post-rock and space rock to everything else. Even when we had our little indie dance episode, there were a lot of men mentioned.
Yeah. You know?
So I think it's time that we had to dedicate an entire episode to all these incredible women that made music in the 90s and early 2000s. So that's what this episode's going to be dedicated to.
So many good ones.
So many good ones. And some that unfortunately, we don't hear about as much. And some that have kind of either reunited or grown their presence to a point where they are, you know, super household, mainstream, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, definitely.
I feel like the movement in the 90s in terms of women really coming into their own probably was, I feel like, the Riot Girl in early 90s kind of Bikini Kill and the Kill Rock Stars type acts. And mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much good stuff that came from that time period.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, Bikini Kills just did a few shows.
Yeah.
Shows, right?
Yeah. And they're playing, I feel like they're playing venues for sure that they never would have played,
giant.
You know, 20 years ago.
Giant.
Like in New York alone, they sold out, what was it? Maybe multiple nights at King's Theater, which is at least 3,000 people.
Wow.
I want to say they sold out Brooklyn Steel as well. Like all these considerable venues. And I mean, not just sold it out immediately to the point where all the tickets are on StubHub for like hundreds upon hundreds
of
dollars.
I think, yeah, people are traveling from really far.
Yep.
Just because there's not that many shows at this point.
So. Yeah.
They all want to be there, you know, at the first reunion shows back. So,
I mean, good for them for getting their money.
Yeah,
you know?
For sure. But yeah, I think that happens, right? Like when a band hasn't played for a really long time and the myth kind of builds up a little bit. And
exactly.
People get excited because they're like, oh, I never thought I'd see them, especially in a big place like that. I'm
mm-hmm.
sure it's pretty wild.
Yeah. But I think, you know, they're definitely people there that are there for the nostalgic factor. But I think also for a lot of these, you know, Gen Zers, they weren't even alive when it was around the first time. So it's their chance to really see it for the, you know.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which kind of blows my mind a bit, but it's kind of cool, you know.
Totally. Yeah. I don't know. I have like a silly memory about Kathleen Hanna.
Yeah.
From a mixtape that my friend Dan made me. He put... I guess she did a cover of it was originally like a Ben Lee song.
Okay.
That was about Evan Dando.
Okay.
And called I Wish I Was Him.
Oh.
Do you know that song?
I don't.
So, yeah, I actually didn't know it was like a cover. I always, you know, just on my tape as Kathleen Hanna. So I was like, oh, did she write a song about Evan Dando? That's kind of weird. But yeah, it's all about like how cool he is, how all the girls want to hang out with him, mm-hmm. all the guys want to be him, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And apparently now Evan Dando sings this song.
Oh, that's funny. Oh, full circle.
Sets. Yeah, so that's pretty fun. I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah. When I think Lemonheads, I think of an act I was really fond of when I was 12, 13, 14 was Juliana Hatfield.
Oh,
it's the
of course.
Same circle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. That Become What You Are album I really, really loved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They like play, like, I think they went on tour together.
At one did they?
Too. Like, you know, later, like in the like 2012 era or something like that.
Uh-huh.
I think I remember seeing them at like Bell House or something.
I recently dug up a ticket stub that was autographed by Juliana Hatfield from Knitting Factory when it was in Tribeca.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, oh, that's kind of a cool find in my box of rando goodies. Yeah. Yeah, I was a big fan of hers. And I feel like that album came out in maybe 93-ish.
Yeah.
So kind of at the start of, I don't know, women really kind of breaking ground in the 90s with music. Yeah. And then I know we talked about Bjork's debut and how we both loved that album. And then, of course, obviously her career now is, she's, you know, there are no words. I mean, she's
beyond.
Yes, beyond. just this creative, you know, behemoth. But that was a great album. That was also from the early 90s that also people didn't know exactly what to do with, because it's like, who is this exactly? And she's going in all these directions and she's fun and she's quirky and she's weird and... you know, she's obviously, she's amazing. But that was another good one, I think, from like the early 90s. And then personally, I was into like more, I guess you can call it more poppier stuff, but like the breakthrough singer-songwriters of the moment, like Tori Amos. The first few Tori Amos albums still mean so much to me, even though I don't revisit them a bunch. But if I were to hear something from Little Earthquakes, Under the Pink, Boys for Pele, Choir Girl Hotel, at this point it still would move me. Actually, I went to an album signing she did about a year or two ago, and I got to meet her, and I gave her this big hug, and it was like an emotional thing for me. I think with a lot of the stuff that we've visited over the course of this season, you know, we were teenagers or early 20s when all this was happening, and we have these connections, you know, and it kind of like, it sticks with you. I don't know how to describe it. It's an emotional thing.
Yeah, I mean, her music was so personal that I feel like it was so personal to fans, too, because, and that's why, like, that's the magic of her, you know, relationship to her fans. So I can totally see that.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I mean, in a way, music is always going to trigger, like, those original feelings, in a way, as, you know, of the age we were when we first experienced it.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I like Tori, but I never like got full, like obsessive into Tori, but I thought she was obviously very talented.
And
she was one of those people, I think like a lot of her songs like came from like kind of emotional pain kind of situations, right? Like really dark. And it's kind of the first time you really like saw somebody like just bearing like their, you know, dark past, you know, into like this music and expressing it.
You know, I recently was watching an interview with her and I had no idea, but you know, Little Earthquakes, which was obviously her debut and breakthrough release with Crucify and, you know, Silent All These Years and so much good stuff, I didn't realize at the time when she presented that album to the label, they said, oh yeah, your songwriting's great, but we're not going to have a piano based album. We'll put you into a studio with some dudes and we'll make this like a Nirvana type release. Wow. And she's like, I'm not doing that. And she fought for it, and apparently it was a big tug of war with the label. I had no idea. Wow. And obviously she won, and it, you know, it's a piano release, it's her and the piano for the most part. So good for her for sticking it out, and also like fighting the man, literally, you know. Quick kudos to Tori for not backing down to her original vision, which I think is so important.
It's super important, and it kind of made her.
Yeah. You know? Particularly when you think of like those men at the label that are in their suits and out of touch. Yeah. And, you know.
Yeah. It's like just being told like what you're supposed to be, like such a big part of like the stupid business. And anyone who can kind of stand up and like stick with who they are is like, you know, inspiring to see, because it's hard in the face of like people telling you, well, this is not going to succeed, you know, and you got to kind of show them, no, it will. Stick to my guns.
You know? Yeah, you got to fight for it. What else were you loving in the early slash mid part of the 90s that were some women fronted acts?
I was super into Elastica. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be Justine Frischmann for sure. I thought she was the coolest.
That band was the coolest. Their look, their sound. Yeah. Actually, A Heart as a Spade is a reference to, my old blog is a reference to a lyric in Connection, which was like their big U.S. single.
I love that. Yeah. It was such a good song off of like such a great album.
Yeah. Their only album, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. She was the only one that like made me want to have short hair. Like, I know, like I always cry when I cut my hair short. I always like forget how awful it is. But I remember being a teenager being like, I want that haircut from the cover of that album.
She was so badass. So yeah. Badass. They had such a good look. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Obviously, super into Kim Gordon.
Of course.
Sonic Youth. I thought, you know, she was also just like super cool in a way more kind of badass sort of way. Mm-hmm. Cause she was kind of like always like her songs sounded arty no matter what. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was super into like that Dirty album and, you know, she had the song Drunken Butterfly that was really good. Mm-hmm. Bull and the Heather, Little Trouble Girl, which she did with Kim Deal, Raiders, and Pixies era.
I got to work very briefly with Kim and Kelly Deal last summer.
That's so cool.
Because the Breeders did a show at a venue I work with. And oh my God, it was, they were so fun. And yeah, it was like a little bit I had to keep myself together. Because I wanted to geek out, but I did not. Oh my God. I kind of held it in until I got home. And then I kind of let out this big scream like, I was just, But I mean, you know.
Oh, they were unbelievably cool.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was looking at my mixtapes, I was like super into, there's like always a good Lush song, always a good song from Versus. Mm-hmm. Lush, they had that song, Lady Killers.
Yeah.
That was like pretty popular. But I was reading that they wrote that song after they did Lollapalooza.
Okay.
And they were playing with like, Red Hot Chili Peppers, so it was kind of like their introduction to like American rock music.
Oh.
And they were like, so they wrote that Lady Killer song kind of almost in reaction to Red Hot Chili
Peppers. I had no idea.
Like about being you know, a man and like not being able to like, you know, women not being able to do what men can. It was kind of a reaction to this kind of very male kind of rock that they were like hearing at Lollapalooza.
That's really cool. And especially I feel like that was maybe their biggest radio alternative single. Modern rock, whatever you want to call that genre, which is kind of dead in the water now, but it probably was played in a lot of situations when it was a hit, like next to a Red Hot Chili Peppers song. You know, so that's kind of amazing. You know,
a lot of Stereo Lab.
Of course, yeah.
I just love them. And they're another one of those bands, like, you didn't always, like, know what they were singing about. But
Yeah. Didn't matter.
It didn't matter because, like, the music was so good and the vocals were good. You didn't have to know what they were singing.
Mm-hmm.
They were on so many of my mixtapes.
Yeah, that's a mixtape kind of band. Yeah.
I remember, like, reading someone posting, like, on Facebook, like, which Stereo, like, I just found out about Stereo Lab, which album should I, you know, start with? And I was just thinking, like, doesn't matter what album you start with them. Like, they're all really good.
They are.
So, yeah, there's no right, you know, order to listen to their album.
Exactly. I feel the same way.
I remember going to see them on the Dots and Loops tour, but now they're coming back, right?
Yeah, I believe so. I never got a chance to see them, which I'm bummed about, but maybe on this upcoming track.
Yeah. I wonder what it's going to be like.
Yeah. Probably kind of different.
A little bit different.
Yeah.
Who else did you listen to?
Well, I feel like in an earlier episode, I went on and on about Garbage, but Garbage was like my thing. I think, you know, when I was listening to kind of like a lot of alternative stuff that was on the radio, I feel like you were discovering stuff that was cooler outside of the mainstream. So I feel like a lot of my mid-90s tastes are very aligned with what was being played on alternative radio. It wasn't until for me the later 90s and early 2000s that my taste expanded fully.
Mm-hmm.
So But yeah. Garbage is one of those bands to this day, like, I still love, and particularly those first couple albums.
I mean, Shirley
and Shirley. Manson. Shirley is, yeah, like I said, yeah, she's my everything. So, you know, Garbage. You know who I saw about a year or two ago was Mazzy Star. They did some sort of, like, reunion thing. They played, and actually it was more than 2 years ago. Maybe it was like 4 years ago now. They played Terminal 5, which is not the best venue, as, no, you know, people in New York giant. Know. Yeah. They were amazing. It was really an emotional experience. And I have to admit, like, I don't remember too many songs outside of, you know, the obvious Fade Into You and some of the other singles from that release. But it was really a beautiful show.
Yeah.
They pretty much played almost entirely in the dark. Wow. Yeah. It was one of those things where you just kind of leave the venue and you there's something that you picked up on. I don't know. I can't explain it, but it was emotional. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that song was very haunting but all over the place, right?
Yeah.
So, like, does it still have the same magic?
It did. And her vocals were flawless.
Wow.
Yeah. It was really pretty. But actually, haunting's the right word. That's how I would describe the whole show.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a long show, too. I feel like they played for over 2 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. It was really great. I'm glad I got to go. You know, I feel like as the mid-90s were, there were certain bands that broke, and particularly women and women-fronted acts, notably, obviously, Alanis, which we'll delve into more later. But, you know, Hole, after Kurt passed and Hole released Live Through This just a couple weeks after, that album really was kind of a moment, and Courtney became kind of the poster child for a lot of things, but notably, like, I feel like a lot of it was outside of the music, her fashion, like, she with the butterflies, the clips in her hair, and the
baby,
what do you call
doll dresses.
Thank you. I was trying to think of the name.
Yeah.
She kind of, in addition to emoting so much with the music and getting that out with her live shows and kind of grieving, I feel like she also was a bit of a fashion plate. You know,
yeah, like a messy,
yeah, yeah.
You know,
but
like,
it was
now
so 90s.
She's, you know, trying to be more cleaned up, or
yes,
whatever. But,
yes.
Back then, she was sort of like a little bit of a mess, and that was like her thing, her look.
That was her thing.
But then she started getting into plastic surgery and more
fashion-y. And Hollywood, and, yeah.
And I don't know, some other kind of thing now.
Yeah, I saw Hole. A few years back, there was some sort of documentary that came out. It wasn't about Hole, but it was Hole adjacent somehow. I forget exactly. I want to say it was like about maybe like women in rock. I hate that term, from like the mid early
sure,
90s.
Sure, yeah.
And anyway, long story short, Hole did a very, very brief, literally like 2 or 3 song reunion set at Public Assembly, which is no longer either.
Oh, wow.
Williamsburg. And of the 3 songs they played, one of them was Miss World from Live Through This, which was really, it was incredible to see that in such a small room, like right near Courtney. In fact, I remember I like assisted her to the stage because I don't know, she was kind of being mobbed and I was right there and I was like, I'll hold your hand and push you up on stage. So that was kind of cool. So anyway, going back to the point at hand, Hole, Garbage. I was an Alanis fan. We'll delve into that more. You know, a band that I discovered kind of early on before they really broke in a bigger way was The Gossip, who date back to, you know, way back. Yeah. I saw them at the Black Hat in D.C. and they played to maybe 30, 40 people. And this is when Beth and The Gossip's music was a lot more punk driven and less poppy. Mm-hmm. And she was less also of like a fashion diva.
Yeah.
But it was, I mean, it was one of those things like catching that show and not knowing a great deal about them at the time. It's like, oh my God, this is amazing.
I know, her energy is incredible.
Yeah.
And I always found her really inspiring. And yeah, I mean, but they were punk, but they were all very kind of, you know, I think, you know, always had a kind of a dancey sort of ness to them.
Yeah. And then they really explored that later on. And then when Beth released some solo stuff that was very disco inspired.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking she, you know, everyone's freaking out now about Lizzo, but
yeah.
I think Beth Ditto is like the original big girl.
Yeah. Like, who's like proud and fierce.
Yeah.
And,
proud and fierce.
Yeah.
And just like owns it, you know?
Yeah.
She's
always been that way. And, you know, and so openly queer and so like, mm-hmm. this is who I am. And if you don't like it, too bad, you right. know? And I really appreciated that. Although that for me was a little more towards the very late 90s, early, you know, 2000s. I also was a big fan of Beth Orton. Mm-hmm. And she, I got a chance to work with her when I was interning at AstroWorks in college, when I was back home in New York. And I remember once she came into the office, she's like over 6 feet tall.
No way.
Yeah, she is. And at first I didn't know who it was, but someone whispered that like that was Beth Orton. I didn't realize she was so tall. And I was wow. like, oh, wow. It was very much like a presence when she walked in. But it was cool. I mean, I was in the marketing department. I was interning and I was working pretty much. My job was to call different record stores around the country and make sure that our releases were, you know, displayed properly in the store and the posters were up and pretty much making it an easy point of sale for the CD, you know? So I got to work briefly with Beth Orton, which was cool. And then just to kind of quickly go over some other acts I was into, I feel like after the Alanis craze of the mid 90s, there were a lot of acts that followed that. I feel like the labels were maybe trying to capitalize on her success. So I was into Tracy Bonham, who had a very short lived career. And her big single was called Mother Mother. I was into a band called Republica, whose big single was called Ready to Go, which was kind of like garbage meets early 90s rave meets like, I don't know, something kind of frantic and crazy. And she also had very bright colored, like red streaked hair. Mm. What else? There was a band I was into that was like a Swedish one-hit wonder. It was fronted by a woman, and they were called Salt.
I love a Swedish one-hit wonder.
Yes. It was interesting because they were kind of grungy. I don't even remember how I discovered them, but I do remember that their single was called Bluster, and I would call Q1043, which was like the hard rock station. Now it's classic rock here in New York, but I would beg them to like play it and, you know, hoping that it would end up on their like nightly countdown of like the top 10 most requested because I called in a million times. I think to this day, I'm probably the only person who remembers this band, but I was into them. I was into Jill Sobule and I Kissed a Girl and that whole thing.
She was the original I Kissed a Girl.
She was the original. and then like this band K's Choice that was kind of cool. I don't remember their origins, to be honest with you, but I do remember liking a couple of their albums. More Chiba was really cool.
Oh yeah, they were really cool.
Yeah. I had a moment where I was really into Sinead O'Connor in college. She put out an album called Faith and Courage. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know why I picked it up. But I was really into it. And there were some good singles on that release. And then I remember being a big fan of Chibo Motto. And recently I got to work with Miho Hattori on a performance she did here in New York. And that was kind of a moment.
Yeah.
I love that Chibo Motto album with, what was it, Stereotype A? Or is that the single or the album? I don't recall. But that moment in like 2000, 2001, I thought they were the shit. I love them.
They were so cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I've worked on shows where Yuka Sihanda was a guest. And, you know, I just love like, I mean, she's still doing like really experimental stuff that's like super interesting. Mm-hmm. So I like really appreciate her as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, yeah, they're still doing cool things, even though they don't always do it as Chibo Motto.
Yeah, yeah. And then so many other acts that, honestly, I either can't remember or were a little more flash in the pan, perhaps. But there was so much. And I feel like a lot of my memories, too, are also tied to, like, Lilith Fair culture from the late 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually was fortunate enough to work with some of these women over the last couple of years. For my day job, notably Lisa Loeb and Joan Osborne, Suzanne Vega. I gotta say, like, they're all pretty damn cool. I don't know. It's kind of bananas because a lot of them, they haven't really aged at all. They still look like it's 1995, you know? But not only that, they more importantly than what they look like, they sound exactly the same. I mean, Suzanne Vega's vocals are, I mean, I don't know what other word to use except flawless. Wow. They're perfect.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, I'm not sure if everyone realizes this, but she's considered the mother of the MP3. You know about this?
No.
Yeah. So apparently when the MP3 was being developed in the, I forget if it was the early or mid 90s, they were trying to find a song that, or a vocal delivery, I should say, that worked perfectly from going to the CD to a digital file. And they were trying with various songs. And then they finally found the one that worked perfectly because the vocal was so clean, and it was Suzanne Vega, Tom's Diner.
Oh yeah. God.
So if you wiki it, you'll see that she's considered the mother of MP3, and she's still like, she's proud of that title.
That's crazy. Yeah. I had no idea.
Yeah. I also worked briefly with Sophie B. Hawkins, which was a trip. She's a little batshit, to be honest with you. But anyway, she was, you know, I mean, I have fond memories of that. I also worked with Donna Lewis fairly recently, who had that single, I Love You Always Forever. and she released a jazz record, which actually was really pretty. So, yeah, I mean, there's so much stuff. You know, this is just kind of the tip of the iceberg, but... Yeah. There was a lot of great stuff. I know that you and I were both fans of early Cranberries stuff.
Yes, I loved Cranberries.
Her voice was really one of a kind.
Yeah.
Yeah. And those songs really touched you. Yes. You know?
Yeah, no, she was incredible. You know, from the softness of Dreams to like the, you know, darker, what was that? The dark what? The
Zombie?
Zombie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting that Zombie was the huge radio single, but it makes sense at the time.
Yeah.
But most of the Cranberries music on the debut and on No Need to Argue was a lot softer.
Yeah.
You know, that was like one of the few kind of heavier guitar tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But of course, like that song Linger that was like everywhere. Kind of more... obscure ones were like Velocity Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Those would always be on mixtape. And one, I know you don't remember them, but they were on, I don't know why they were on so many of my mixtapes, but Arson Garden.
Okay.
I think we're from the Midwest and more like they were calling it melodic metal.
I don't remember this. I'm gonna have to research.
Yeah, look it up.
Okay.
They were pretty cool.
For our repeat skip.
But we picked a couple women who kind of symbolize independence in one way or another.
Absolutely. These were both albums. Huge albums.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess first we could talk about Alanis.
Yeah. I feel like, Jagged Little Pill was such a juggernaut from the 90s.
Yeah.
Before we delve into this, I just want to like quickly give a quick kudos to her because she actually recorded the video for Hand in My Pocket in Brooklyn. And a couple of my friends in high school randomly wound up in the video because they heard there was like some film shoot going on where some musician's going to be driving down this, like, I think it was Fifth Avenue in Brooklyn, in some sort of like faux parade. And they just were like, okay. So they came down because I think at the time, You Ought to Know either had just come out when they were recording this video, or maybe it wasn't even out. So they didn't know what they were walking into. And a couple of them wound up in the video, like having little cameos.
Oh my God.
So I gotta say, like, Alanis came to Brooklyn before it was like, you know, cool to come to Brooklyn. So kudos, Alanis.
Kudos.
This album was really important to me when I was like 14, 15. I mentioned this, but my first show was Alanis at Jones Beach with Radiohead. I had all the Alanis t-shirts. It's embarrassing to admit, but like, I was like, I worshipped Alanis for a couple years during like my teenage years. Saw her a bunch and I don't even know. I mean...
I always thought she was like a little naughty with that You Ought to Know
song. Of course.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I kind of liked, you know, that being like, you know, the first song that I heard of hers, like, I was like, wow, this woman is like super, edgy,
mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, like going down, talking about like going down on people
in a theater. Yeah.
I thought that was, whoa, I can't believe she's talking about this. But, you know, so she definitely had this, like, kind of aggressive, you know, bad girl kind of vibe in that first song. But not always.
Not always. But she got kind of categorized as the angry woman. But actually, a lot of that release is kind of sweet. I mean, a song like Head Over Feet is a love song, you know?
Yeah. It's weird to think that, did she write this album for
she
that
wrote this
guy?
Oh, the guy from Full House.
Full House. Joey.
Yes. So a lot of these songs. Yes. A lot of these songs are about Joey from Full House. Dave Coulier.
Yes. Oh, Dave Coulier.
I mean, I think You Ought to Know is about him.
Yeah, right?
And like, then you get a visual.
So funny. Yeah. So you're just like, him? Okay.
Apparently him. Yeah. No, but I remember, yeah, when You Ought to Know video came out, and before I even really was like listening so much to lyrics, I was like, I just love what, like, the sound. I love her whole, like, how she's running around with that crazy long hair. She looks so cool.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I bought Jagged Little Pill, and it was really, I have to admit, like, an obsession. And then supposed former infatuation junkie I was into. And then I kind of lost the thread a little bit. But anyway, what were your best moments from this album, your repeat?
Well, aside from You Ought to Know, when I was re-listening to it, I was into Wake. I think most of them, it was kind of hard because like a lot of them kind of became like a little caricature-ish, mm-hmm. like cartoonish, after they became like hits, because there were so many kind of single hits.
A lot of singles from this album.
Yeah. But I didn't mind Wake Up, actually. Mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty decent.
Yeah.
But what about you? What were some of your favorites?
I mean, I really was like, this whole album meant a lot to me back in the day, although a lot of these songs I would not go back to. But I have to say You Ought to Know, because that's the moment when I fell in love with her. Mm-hmm. I also really loved All I Really Want, the opening track.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lyric very towards the beginning of that song where she says something like, my sweater's on backwards and inside out. And I, for some reason, when I was 14, I thought that was really cool. I remember in gym class, I would wear this oversized sweater backwards and inside out and think I was amazing. And people would ask me questions and I'd be like, don't you know that's an Alanis lyric? They're like, not really.
You're trying to start a trend.
Yeah, I was. It didn't really take off. I think also as a bit of a chunky kid, like it was a way for me to like, be kind of edgy fashion wise and also cover up my body a little right. bit. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I was into that. But I mean, I really loved this whole album. You know, I want to give a quick shout out to my brother because he actually was at that very first Alanis show with me in 96. And he was so ill that day. I remember like he was running to the restroom and like, I feel bad because I was living my best life and he was I don't know, dealing with all this, but
wow.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. We had like a little, I'm just gonna go off topic for a quick second here. We had like a little radio station thing that we would do. We had two different cassette recorders and we would tape stuff from the radio and then tape stuff from like the MTV Video Music Awards and make, I don't know, we would play around with all the buttons and make these little radio stations. And I had like the rock station that played Alanis and he had the R&B station. I don't know. It was just kind of silly stuff, but fond memories when we were a kid. But I would probably skip Forgiven, which was like, I don't know, her kind of like religious track, sort
of.
Yeah.
Kind of a Catholic vibe to it. Something.
Yeah. What would you skip?
You know, I chose Not the Doctor. A lot of them kind of turned a little corny.
Yes, they did.
That was like definitely one of them.
Yeah.
Oh, but you know, when I was younger, this just goes back to like when you're younger, your emotions just seem so much more serious back then. But I remember listening to that song Perfect and thinking like, oh, I relate to this so much. Like my parents don't get me.
Yeah.
They're pushing me to be like too, like, you know, academic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I thought when I was like 15, I guess, I'm sure, like, I definitely was like listening to that song, probably crying.
Try a little harder.
Exactly.
The lyrics are so bad. A lot of these albums so that bad. We've been revisiting this season are just like not that great in retrospect lyrically.
I know, I have to laugh at myself when I think about like how I was like listening to them so hard.
You know, Jagged Little Pill obviously was a huge album, but it wasn't until I researched it recently to see like what were total album sales. Because, you know, Jagged Little Pill was an off-Broadway hit, not even in New York, but I believe in Boston, and it's coming to Broadway this fall. But that album in the US alone sold 19 million copies.
Wow.
Isn't that bananas?
That's insane.
And it makes it like one of the top 10 or 20 albums ever in the U.S. outside of like Michael Jackson Thriller and like the Eagles Greatest Hits and stuff.
That's like crazy.
It's crazy numbers. Yeah.
Ugh. like, it doesn't even make sense.
I know. So I mean, those numbers are completely unattainable now nowadays, but yeah. 19
million.
I guess
she had so many hits off that album.
Yeah.
Like, so even if they were a joke, you know, like Ironic was like a huge joke.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, every play counts, so,
yeah.
You know.
She got her money early, you know.
Yeah, when it was still possible.
And then internationally, the album has sold 33 million albums.
Wow. Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah. Or 33 million copies, I should say. It's, yeah, it's kind of bananas.
It's weird to think of it as a Broadway play.
Yeah. I have to admit, like, if I do see it, I kind of want to go in not knowing what they're going to do. So I haven't really read the reviews. I don't know.
Yeah. Is it like memoirish or is it just like something they put together with the songs?
I think it's the latter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
Dave Cooley.
He's the guest star. Can you imagine? No. Please no.
Definitely not.
No, no. And the other album that we have for our repeat skip, our last one of the season, is another classic from the 90s, Liz Phair, Exile in Guyville.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So good.
This was so good.
I mean, just a classic.
Yeah, go into it. What were your memories of this?
You know, I remember, like, listening to it and being, like, just blown away with, like, how raw and honest it felt and, like... Like, nothing else out there at the time, you know. And I mean, I think she submitted it to, like, Matador as, like, just, like, these demos. And if you listen to some of the demos, I think, like, sometimes the demos are, like, cool to listen to. Mm-hmm, see how each song evolved. But, you know, obviously, when Fuckin' Run came out, that also, I was like, who is this woman? How is she so bold? And like,
yeah.
You know, to be just talking about sex like that, like, I just wasn't used to it. So I always found that, like, just mind-blowing. I was just like, she could just sing about this and not be embarrassed. You know, I thought that was cool. What about you?
I got into this album a couple years later because I wasn't as hip in 93 for me. It took a couple years. But, I mean, I played this album a lot during my college radio years, even though at that point it was quite a few years old. I thought that 6 Foot One, the opening track, was great. I just love that lyric that kind of gives you, like, the visual where she's like, I wish I were 6 Foot One instead of 5 Foot Two.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I think, you know, outside of the obvious, like, mention to height, like, it kind of is... I don't know. It has this weird aspirational element to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I loved Mesmerizing. I thought that just had, like, a great, catchy chorus. I thought that was a great track. I think a lot of the songs on this album do sound similar to one another, but not in a bad way.
Yeah.
You know?
No. I mean, it just felt like one artist was putting out this album.
Yeah.
For sure. And, you know, some of them were dirty. Some of them were, like, more melodic than others. I mean, other than Fuckin' Run, which was, you know, just like the big single off of it, as in the Girls, 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 and also Shatter I liked because it was also something that built up, you know, like mostly instrumental and then halfway, like, lyrics start coming and they're just so, like, emotional and, like, something about it, like, really kind of rang with me. So I remember, like, listening to that song a lot. What were your skips?
I skipped Glory. Not that it's necessarily a poor track, just not one that I remembered as well.
Yeah.
I think also, as I've been saying the last few episodes, like, I like a fuller picture of a song. I think this was a little bit more of a shorter and also kind of softer track. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of these songs were a little more gritty, and that one broke the mold a little bit.
Yeah.
So it kind of stood out in not the greatest way. But I think as a standalone track, it's fine. But maybe in the context of the album, wasn't my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I chose like Johnny Sunshine and Soapstar Joe as like my skips. Nothing wrong with them overall, but probably just less appealing to me than any of the other songs. But like, she was actually one of those artists that I saw, like, when I went to NYU and they would have like these concerts for like the student body. And I remember like she performed that song Flower.
Oh yeah, that was a naughty one.
Yeah, yeah, and that was super naughty, and I just remember thinking, like, I can't believe she's singing this live. It's so dirty. And just being like, just, I don't know, I just thought that was really cool.
I'm gonna see her for the first time this summer. Ooh. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, yeah. But I have not seen her live.
I bet she's still really awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I know she did like a brief kind of, they re-released Exile with like B-sides and demos and all that kind of stuff recently. Mm-hmm. And she did a small tour, but this is going to be part of something bigger, I believe.
Oh, cool.
But, you know, I have fond memories, and I know that this is like the critically like bashed album, but in around 2000, 2001, she joined forces with like the producer who put out all this top 40 stuff at the time, notably like Avril Lavigne and Pink. Oh, right, and stuff.
Right.
And she released, I mean, the most poppy album of her career, and it was tacky as hell, but it had some good singles on it and like songs you could really sing along to. And yeah, the big one was Why Can't I? You remember that one?
No, how did that go?
Why can't I breathe whenever I think about you?
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was totally more on the poppy.
Oh, movie. Yeah, yeah.
Maybe I don't know that album as much. What was it called?
I think it's self-titled. I think the album cover, she's nude and holding this guitar as if it were like man, I guess. Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it, everyone hated that album. That was a critic. But I thought it had its moments. And actually, she's kind of naughty on that album, too. There's a song titled HWC, and you don't really know what it is until you press play. And HWC is actually an acronym for Hot White Cum. And it's like a poppy sing-along kind of track. And she's talking about how she uses that for her hair, her skin. And I'm like, oh my God.
Wow.
Yeah. So she went there. But she went there in a different way than someone like Peaches went there.
Yeah.
You know, where Peaches, it was a lot more explicit. I mean, this is explicit too, but a little more, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. They're different.
Different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One was more like singer-songwriter vibe, and the other one was more like, I don't know, there's some kind of other kind of edge to it.
Yeah, you
know?
Yeah.
But, you know, like, I liked her other albums, too, though. Like, I remember liking Whip Smart.
Oh, Whip Smart's great. I love White Chocolate Space Egg, which was a little more poppy, admittedly, a little later on.
Yeah.
Yeah, she had a bunch of good
besides
releases.
Besides that, though, I mean, those were probably the two albums.
Yeah.
After Exile.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't even know she put one out in 2010, but now I'm seeing that she did it. Like, oh, okay.
Her star is kind of faded, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, if it's, you know, if you kind of change and get, like, way poppy, like, yeah, when she worked with The Matrix or whatever, like, it's just like, you're gonna be different. You're gonna become Avril.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, always, like, complicated as a guilty
of
pleasure.
Of course,
but,
yeah.
Like, you know. It's got a certain corniness to it.
I wonder why she decided to like go in a total 100% pop direction, you know?
Well, sometimes you get pressured to.
Yeah, probably, maybe that's part of it.
She's on a major label.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not Matador anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you're on a different level and you have to appeal to mainstream, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and get on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I imagine she just gets pressure from her peoples.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. But unfortunately, that was that whole idea of putting her in the pop universe didn't really work out so hot. Yeah.
She'll never have another Exile.
No,
sure.
No, no.
But, you know, it was really good.
It was also of the time.
Yeah.
Like, it wouldn't work now.
No.
You know?
No.
All right, so that was our season finale.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe we did it. 10 episodes.
Thanks for sticking with us.
Yes, and looking forward to bringing you more in season 2.
Of Mixtape Memories.
Yay.
See you.
See you.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.